Certain information set forth in the podcast may contain forward-looking statements under applicable security laws. These statements are not guarantees of future performance, and undue reliance should not be placed on them. Although forward-looking statements contained in this presentation are based upon what management of the company believes to be reasonable assumptions, there can be no assurance that forward-looking statements will prove to be accurate. LifeSci Advisors and the company undertake no obligation to update forward-looking statements in the podcast should circumstances or management's estimates or opinions change. This podcast is for general information purposes only. It is not an offer or solicitation to buy securities and does not constitute investment advice.
We've now treated, I think, 13 patients in Ukraine, almost all of whom have suffered wartime injuries, mostly blast wounds and shrapnel wounds. In some cases, these patients or soldiers already had a failed vein bypass or a failed Dacron bypass that didn't work, and then they got the HAV to try to restore blood flow. I can tell you that so far, from the information that we have, we've had 100% success.
Hello, my name is Neil Canavan, and this is Benchtop Bios, a podcast series by LifeSci Partners where we introduce healthcare investors to the people and the pipelines driving the biotech sector forward. My guest today is Dr. Laura Nicholson. She is the founder and CEO of Humacyte. Doctor, welcome to Benchtop Bios.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
All right, now let's start off with a quick introduction to your company before a longer discussion about the person in charge. Doctor, give me the elevator pitch for Humacyte.
Well, Humacyte is really a first-in-class regenerative medicine company and technology. We're really category-defining innovation. We use a bank of human cells that we've isolated and propagated to make human tissues, essentially human spare parts, in a variety of shapes and sizes to treat a variety of disease conditions. Importantly, the way we grow and decellularize these tissues means that they can go into any human recipient without rejection.
Okay, I'm going to ask for a lot more of the technical details there because manufacturing is key to this operation. But first, in keeping with the mission of Benchtop Bios, I want to know a bit more about the boss, and that's you. So I'm going to get real basic. Doctor, where were you born?
I was born in Evanston, Illinois.
Evanston, Illinois. All right. Lots of trees, kind of cold in the winter. Tell me just a bit about that place and time as far as your friends are concerned. If I went back to, say, your high school buddies that said, oh, yeah, Dr. Nicholson is A, a doctor, and B, the head of a biotech company, would anyone be surprised? I mean, were you really competitive or were you a nerd? Or tell me about that.
Well, I think the schooling and the family I grew up in was, I would say, very nerdy and very technical. My mother was a biochemist. My father's an organic chemist.
Whoa, yeah.
I grew up assuming that I would be a scientist of some sort. I didn't really think of myself as the CEO of a publicly traded company back then, certainly. But I certainly saw myself as a physician and a scientist, and I think my friends would have also.
Okay, when you're forming teams in PE, were you always the captain?
No, I was always last.
Oh, no. Oh, poor nerds.
Always.
I know too much of this experience. All right, so let's move on to something better, something you're more suited for, and that turns out to be biophysics. And given your example of your parents, this is almost a genetic thing here. You majored in biophysics at University of Chicago Champaign, class 83. Then you doubled down on that, and you got a PhD in biophysics in 88. University of Chicago, which is, you've never seen it, dear listeners, is gorgeous. So biophysics, wet math, if you will. I have a degree in molecular biology. Biophysics was the bane of my existence and coursework. Why, doctor? Why the interest in biophysics?
Well, I think I also studied physics in college, and I really had, I think, an aptitude for more mechanical, physical, mathematical things. But I was always interested from the time I was little in doing medicine, in fixing disease and curing humans. And so combining those in a biophysics sort of education paradigm is what I chose to do.
All right. So you actually doubled down on what your parents managed to accomplish because this was a joint program, PhD, MD. Why? I mean, that's a long haul.
Well, I went to college kind of assuming that I was going to go to medical school and then become a medical researcher, quote unquote. And I remember in my sophomore year, an advisor in college at University of Illinois saying to me, you can't possibly be a successful medical researcher unless you go out there and get both degrees. And so I remember walking out of his office and sort of blinking at the sunlight, thinking that I had just chewed up another 4 or 5 years of my life. But no. He told me I had to do that. So I did that.
Well, that leads me right into my next questions. I talk to a lot of very successful people. And when I ask them this question, there's always an answer, which is the mentor. Who is the person that was responsible for you being who you are today? And it's not a parent, not a relative. So for you, doctor, would it be that person that told you to go back to get the MD, or who would it be?
I think it would probably be the man who I worked for at MIT when I was doing my postdoc in the mid-90s. That would be Robert Langer.
Okay, that's just cheating.
He taught me to seize big problems and to work on them and to drive them toward solutions. I guess the other person I would point out was actually one of my surgeon mentors when I was finishing my medical degree at the University of Michigan. His name is Bob Bartlett. He's one of the people who developed ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which keeps premature babies alive. And he was really an applied bioengineer. And he said to me, pick a big problem, Laura, spend 10 or 15 years and solve it. Well, I did pick a big problem, but I'm about 28 years into the problem. So we're getting there.
Okay, so let's move on from that. So you got your MD, you did your residency at Mass General in anesthesiology. And then after that, you did some research at MIT. What were you involved in there?
Well, at MIT, while I was working in Langer's lab, I decided to try to embark on growing spare parts, in this case, human arteries, trying to grow them from scratch in the lab. The field of tissue engineering was really nascent at that time. It was becoming a source of big sort of popular excitement and scientific excitement in the mid to late 90s. And I was sort of becoming involved right at the beginning of that initial wave. I would say that one of the things that made me want to grow arteries was, aside from the fact that arterial disease causes a majority of the misery of the Western human world in terms of diseases, in addition to that, I had a particular patient who I was caring for when I was doing my residency at Mass General. This was a man who was having a heart bypass operation for coronary artery disease. And most of the time, when you need a heart bypass, we cut open your leg and we take a vein out of your leg to do that bypass and replace the artery. Mm-hmm. Turns out, in this case, this man was asleep on the table, his chest was open. The surgeons looked for a vein in his right leg, cut open the leg, but the vein wasn't suitable, so they sewed it back up. They then cut open his left leg. That vein was not suitable, so they sewed it back up. They then cut open his left arm, thinking that they could take the radial artery from the left arm. That was their initial plan, but then they decided that it would put the hand at risk, so they closed up that incision. And then they made a fourth incision and extended the chest incision into the abdomen and took an artery off the surface of the stomach and swung it up into the chest as a bypass. And this was really a barbaric thing to watch over a 2 or 3 hour period. And it made me think there's got to be a better way. Rather than robbing Peter to pay Paul, we're right now developing methods to grow tissues in the lab. So why don't we try to grow arteries?
Okay, so now you have the impetus, this horrible example, to start a company, the motivation to start a company, but you've never started a company and you've never worked in a company to this point. And in fact, this is the only company you've ever worked for. You have a board position in another company, but this is your baby, one and only. Let's go back to the mentorship question for just a moment. Did either of those mentors give you the lessons in leadership where you thought, okay, I can do this?
Well, I would say Langer probably gave me some of those lessons, but it's also important to know that I didn't start the company out of the gate. I worked on arterial engineering for a period of 10 years at MIT and then at Duke University. And initially, it wasn't clear that the concepts would work. It wasn't clear that we would be successful. When I published my first paper on this, which was kind of a landmark paper in Science Magazine in 1999, I was approached by multiple VCs asking me to start a company. And honestly, I felt like it was too early. And we didn't spin it out for another 4 or 5 years because I felt like I needed to have better assurance that I could make this work in humans. So actually, the company was spun out in 2004, but I had been working on the problem for a decade before that.
All right, so let's go right to the description of technology. We're talking about human acellular vascular tissue. What is that? How do you make it?
Well, Humacyte has developed really a proprietary set of technologies. One of the key components of that is the starting cell bank. So Humacyte has worked for more than a decade isolating human vascular cells and really characterizing them and identifying cell types that are extremely good at regrowing new tissues. They have more progenitor cell or more stem cell characteristics, mm-hmm. and these cells are highly efficient. We then take those cells and we seed them onto a biodegradable scaffold. It's made out of a polymer that's rapidly degrading. And the polymer scaffold is really a mesh, and it can be formed into kind of any shape we want. So in order to grow an artery, we make a tubular version of this mesh, and the dimensions of the tube dictate the final dimensions of the artery that we grow. So currently, the arteries that we're growing are 40 centimeters in length and 6 millimeters in diameter. And that's a size that can be used to treat a whole range of conditions. Anyway, we seed the cells onto the mesh. We then immerse them in a proprietary culture medium that stimulates the cells to grow and essentially remake an artery from scratch. While the cells are growing, we also pulse them. We stretch them in a cyclic way that really mimics the action of your heart on your arteries every time your heart beats. As it turns out, that mechanical stimulus is really very important for coaxing these cells to make a new artery essentially from scratch. After 2 months, we managed to make a human artery that's mechanically very strong. 2 months sounds like a long time, but if you compare it to the human fetus, which takes 9 months, I think we're doing pretty good. At the end of that process, we then remove the culture medium and we replace it with decellularization solutions. So we wash the original donor cells out of the engineered artery. So what gets implanted into patients is engineered human vascular extracellular matrix that's mechanically very robust. It's just as strong as a native artery, but there's no cells in the tissue to get rejected. And that makes us universally implantable.
Okay, so there's no HLA, there's no trigger for the immune system here. Obviously, we're talking about an off-the-shelf product. You say 2 months from inception to the final product. What's the shelf life?
The shelf life is a year and a half currently.
Wow. Okay.
Stored under refrigerated conditions. So we have industrialized this process and we grow 200 vessels now at a time and a single batch that's a highly automated process that actually doesn't require a lot of manpower. After we grow the 200 vessels and decellularize them, we will separate the individual vessels from the batch and we'll destructively test a subset, a small subset, and then the rest gets shipped to hospitals and clinics where they sit in the refrigerator until they're used for any one of our ongoing clinical trials.
Okay. We started with someone's actual cells. Does the source of the cells matter?
The source of the cells matters a lot. Humacyte uses cells that have been derived from extensively tested organ and tissue donors. So for example, if a patient dies and becomes an organ donor, their kidney might go someplace, their liver might go someplace else. Humacyte worked with organ procurement organizations over a period of years and procured the large blood vessels of these patients under consent and then screened the cells from these patients. In fact, we screened cells from more than 700 patients in this process over more than a decade. A small subset of those donors, only about 5 or 6, produce cells that are suitable for our process and that have tremendously long growth potential. So the cell bank that we have in hand right now is enough to support our commercial production for the next 30 or 40 years.
Okay. So we don't have to worry about the source anymore. All right. So let's move on. We have the manufacturing. We have the product. Let's talk about how we're going to use it. There are three programs I'm going to highlight primarily today. One is in peripheral artery disease, or PAD. One is vascular trauma, which is self-explanatory. And the third is dialysis AV access. I'm going to start with vascular trauma. Doctor, give me a description of vascular trauma injury and current standard of care.
Well, vascular trauma can be either civilian or military. If you add up the number of civilian U.S. traumatic injuries, it's actually much greater than the number of military injuries, even in wartime. But vascular trauma can be caused by car accidents, gunshot wounds, industrial accidents, etc. It's anything that damages an artery such that the supply to the body part or the limb is endangered if you don't restore blood flow quickly.
Okay.
Current standards of care right now includes essentially damaging the patient to harvest vein from one uninjured limb and to move it over and to repair the artery that's damaged. So while it's an invasive standard of care, the reason it is the standard of care is because native veins tend to resist getting infected. That's because they're native human tissue.
Right.
So because traumatic injuries are typically not sterile, they typically are contaminated with microorganisms, using a vein to do that repair is considered the gold standard. If a patient doesn't have vein that's suitable or available, or if there's no time to harvest vein, then right now surgeons are forced to use synthetic grafts made out of Teflon or Dacron. But if you talk to any trauma or vascular surgeon, he'll tell you that he or she would rather not use that because of the risk of infection is quite high.
Okay. Now, for this indication, you're running the V005 trial. This is a phase 2-3 trial. The targeted enrollment is 75 patients. Then thinking about how you would run a controlled trial in this setting, do the patients have to have the same severity and location of injury?
So yes, that's an interesting challenge in studying traumatic injury in any form. And that's one reason that, amongst many other challenges, has meant that there are actually very few controlled trials that are done in vascular trauma. Because by definition, your patients are rolling into the ER at 2 a.m. and they're bleeding out and half the time they're not conscious. And trying to subset those patients and come up with similar injuries is actually a huge challenge.
I can imagine.
So
yeah.
In light of this, and also because the Defense Department actually named Humacyte's HAV a top 5 priority for gaining FDA approval a couple years ago, because the Defense Department wants to use our vessel to treat wounded warfighters. Because of that, the FDA has agreed with us that this pivotal trial will be a single arm trial, and that we will make some effort to focus on specific injuries. So we're focusing on injuries of the limb, upper and lower limbs. We've also treated torso injuries. But for purposes of looking at the patient set, we're focusing on limb injuries primarily, which is the majority of vascular injuries.
And you have some data from these trials already, yes?
Because this is a single-arm trial, we're not blinded, and we know how things are going. So
right, okay.
We've implanted more than 60 patients. What I can tell you is that we've had no amputations due to the failure of the vessel itself. Mm-hmm. We've had no rejections, and we've had only one patient develop an infection of the HAV out of more than 60, which is an infection rate of less than 2%. You can compare that to the infection rate you might expect with a synthetic graft, which would be closer to 20 or 40%. So All what right. this means is that in the trauma setting, the HAV, which is literally immediately available, it can be pulled off the shelf, just like a Dacron graft can be pulled off the shelf immediately. You can restore blood flow to an injured patient immediately, but the infection risk that goes along with the plastic grafts doesn't seem to be a problem for our product candidate.
When can we expect the next readout?
Well, we're continuing enrollment in our trial. We're also expanding sites. And we've also used this conduit in wartime injuries in Ukraine, which I think we may talk about a little later. But we anticipate talking about the top line data from all of these experiences in the first half of 2023, this year. And we expect that this data will support a filing, a biologics licensing application to the FDA in vascular trauma in the middle of this year, around the middle of 2023.
All right. So you've just described the technology and you mentioned the situation. This could not be any more topical. Ukrainian soldiers are being massively injured by the tens of thousands. You are working with the Ukrainians on this. Tell me about this initiative.
Well, as you may recall, the Russians invaded Ukraine in February of 2022. Starting in March, we began getting emails from vascular and trauma surgeons in Ukraine asking for access to the HAV. And this was because they had heard about our use of the HAV in other clinical indications and in trauma, and they wanted to see if they could gain access. So we worked with the FDA and with the Ukrainian government and worked out a set of procedures to ship the HAVs to 5 frontline hospitals in Ukraine. Now, again, the HAV is not approved anywhere in the world. And so this is an investigative product that was sent to frontline hospitals. The HAVs arrived in June. We then trained the Ukrainian surgeons on how to use the HAVs, how to implant them in Ukrainian over Zoom.
Wow.
That was an effort, but it went well. And I can tell you that since that time, we've now treated, I think, 13 patients in Ukraine, almost all of whom have suffered wartime injuries, mostly blast wounds and shrapnel wounds. These are very complex, very dirty wounds, as you might imagine. In some cases, these patients or soldiers already had a failed vein bypass or a failed Dacron bypass that didn't work, and then they got the HAV to try to restore blood flow. I can tell you that so far, from the information that we have, we've had 100% success. So we've had no amputations, we've had no rejections, we've had no infections, despite the fact that some of these wounds are very contaminated. So our real-world evidence in an austere environment, in a wartime setting, I think it really validates the reason that the Defense Department made us a top five priority a few years ago.
Right. I can see that. Wow. Okay, let's move on to something a bit lighter, I guess, if you will. The next indication I'd like to discuss, if for no other reason, I don't really know what it is, which is AV access for dialysis. Doctor, what is that? And what's the unmet need here?
Well, kidney failure is fatal unless you go on hemodialysis or other forms of dialysis. To have dialysis, typically what patients must do is they must go to a dialysis center three times a week. Right. And sit in a chair for 4 or 5 hours. What happens is the nurse sticks two needles, large bore needles, into a blood vessel in their arm or their leg. Through one needle, they pull blood out of the patient and run it through a dialysis machine, and then the blood returns to the patient. And that cleansing of the blood in the dialysis machine over a few hours has to accomplish what your kidneys would normally do over a few days. In order to do that, we need to pull blood out of the patient and return it to the patient at a very high rate, like half a liter a minute. As it turns out, your body isn't designed to have arteries that sit right underneath your skin that have a blood flow rate of half a liter per minute. That you're not evolved to be built like that. And so to facilitate dialysis, what surgeons must do is they must either bring a vein to the surface and sew it directly to an artery, or they must sew in a plastic graft, like made out of Teflon, between an artery and a vein and tunnel it right underneath the skin. Either way, the goal is to provide a large bore vessel that's right underneath the skin that has a high blood flow rate that nurses can access with needles.
Okay. I think I've actually seen this. It's like a large bulge under the skin that you can easily hit.
Yes. Fistulas, which is where an artery and a vein are sewn together, can often appear as a large bulge and can even be kind of unsightly because in some patients, the veins dilate to become very large, even centimeters large. One of the limitations, well, there are important limitations with all the current means of dialysis access right now. If you have a catheter in your neck that's made out of plastic, or if you have a plastic graft in your arm, the chances are pretty good that that conduit is going to become infected over the next months to years. And when that infection occurs, it can cause sepsis and can be life-threatening. Similarly, or perhaps a different problem, is when you sew an artery and a vein together in hopes of making a large blood vessel underneath the skin, sometimes that vein doesn't dilate up properly over the ensuing months to allow dialysis. In fact, 40% of the time, when a surgeon makes a fistula between an artery and a vein, that operation doesn't work. And so then patients are left with a catheter in their neck and all of the infectious complications that go along with that. So Humacyte's current phase 3 trial, which we're at the very tail end of enrolling, we're almost done, is a systematic comparison of our HAV sewn into the arm between an artery and a vein, right underneath the skin, comparing the usability of that HAV to the usability of a fistula, which is where we sew an artery and a vein directly together. And this is a randomized prospective trial. We're targeting about 240 patients, and we've enrolled more than 230. So we're getting painfully close to being done.
So I don't know why this didn't occur to me before to ask, what's the lifespan of this product in the body?
Well, we're still addressing and learning about how durable this product can be. I can tell you that our very first patients that we implanted, which would have been starting in December of 2012, more than 10 years ago, a small number of these patients are still using their vessels for dialysis access 10 years later, which is actually extraordinary durability in dialysis.
Right.
We also recently published a paper in peripheral arterial disease showing that our vessels have great durability out to at least 6 years in those patients. We think that the durability and the resistance to infection may both come from the same cause. And it may be that because when it's implanted, the HAV is non-cellular. We wash the cells mm-hmm. out. But we know from studying patient biopsies that after the HAV is implanted, cells from the patient migrate in and they turn the vessel into a living structure. Because it's a living tissue, we believe that that confers it an ability to heal after needle punctures and durability and also resistance to infection.
Got it. All right. So you alluded to almost fully enrolled. Your target is 240 patients. I don't know if you mentioned it and I missed it. When can we expect a final readout?
So after we complete enrollment, which should be in the next month or two, because we've got fewer than 10 patients we need to enroll, then our top line readout would be available about a year later. Our key endpoints are usability for dialysis over 6 and 12 months.
Got it. Okay. Now, the last indication we will touch on today is PAD or peripheral artery disease. Doctor, describe a typical patient in this setting and again, the standard of care.
So peripheral artery disease is essentially a disease of older persons. It basically is caused by progressive atherosclerosis or narrowing of the arteries, typically in the legs, that can be rather insidious and can really manifest as sort of legs that become tired or cramped when you're walking or trying to jog or trying to go up a flight of stairs. And this disease is progressive in the sense that unless therapy is undertaken, then eventually tissues in the legs and feet become ischemic and can become necrotic and can lead to amputation. So many patients with PAD actually are not out in the world very much. You don't see them on vacations or in shopping malls because moving around is hard. And so I think there's an underappreciation for the public in general about how vast this disease is. It affects many millions of people in the U.S. and the numbers are growing. A standard treatment for PAD is to take vein from that leg or from another leg and use it as a bypass, again, to bypass clogged arteries. As you might imagine, though, patients with PAD sometimes don't do well if you injure their legs to steal vein. And also sometimes those patients with PAD need vein for a heart bypass that may have already occurred. So many patients don't have suitable vein. And then they're left with these plastic grafts that we discussed that are known to not work very well, particularly in advanced disease, and particularly if you need to treat arteries that are below the knee.
All right. So you have data from two completed phase two trials for this indication already in hand. Could you give me just a top line sampling of that?
So we've treated two different patient populations in our phase two trials. The longest running phase two trial treated patients mostly with above the knee grafts that had moderate to severe limb ischemia. Those outcomes we actually just published a 6-year update on just in the last week or two. And what we saw was a really remarkable function. So the HAV by imaging was very durable, did not become narrowed and did not dilate over time, so mechanically robust. We had no amputations in the operative limb in any of our 20 patients, which is also fairly remarkable given how long the follow-up is and how diseased these patients were. In a second trial, which we haven't read out yet, this is a U.S. trial in more severely affected patients. These are all patients with what we would call critical limb ischemia. These are patients who were really facing imminent amputation if they didn't get revascularization of their limbs. Those data have similar outcomes. Again, we haven't reported those formally yet, and so I'm not in a position to share those at this time. But what I can also tell you about is that we've collaborated with the Mayo Clinic, and vascular surgeons at the Mayo Clinic have undertaken essentially a broad compassionate use program where they've implanted 25 patients now, all of whom had critical limb ischemia, all of whom were facing amputation, and who had no other options to revascularize their limbs except for the HAV. And those studies are going well. Again, they're in the process of being reported. So I would say that certainly in this population of high unmet need, especially patients who are facing amputation, it seems that the HAV may be an option for them.
So we're talking about three separate indications. You now have a lot of patients. I don't know what the total is, but it's getting up there. Have you had any safety signals that might be in common between the three cohorts or related to the product at all?
So we have not had any important safety signals across these cohorts. Again, our infection rates are very low. We've seen no instances of clinical rejection. We've implanted over 500 patients and have over 1,000 patient years of follow-up. So again, we're not yet approved, and we have not yet submitted our BLA to the FDA. And so I'm not going to sit here and tell you that our product is known to be safe, because that's a decision that's made by the regulators.
Okay.
But I can tell you that we have not seen any consistent safety signals.
All right, just a couple more questions to wrap up. I do want to ask about a recent publication. This came out, it was written by the surgeons at Walter Reed Hospital in D.C., and it came out in the Annals of Vascular Surgery regarding some case studies using your product. What was their conclusion? They're thrilled to use it or helpful? What'd they say?
Yes. Yeah, so this is a summary of some compassionate use cases. So beyond the compassionate use program at the Mayo, Humacyte has been responding to surgeon requests from around the country asking to use the HAV in certain extraordinary circumstances. So these are extraordinary cases of trauma. We treated one patient who was essentially crushed by a forklift. We have patients who are cancer patients who are at risk of losing a limb due in part to their cancer and their vascular disease, really end stage cases. And in whenever we're able to, we supply the HAVs to those patients and surgeons when they request. And this was really a compilation of some of those cases that was reported by the Walter Reed surgeons. And what they found was that in the majority of cases, these patients salvaged limbs and went on to do well. Not all of the patients did well. Some of the patients had just overwhelming catastrophic injuries that were really not treatable under any circumstance. But overall, I think the surgeons believe that this is a great tool to have in their armamentarium. And we continue to get frequent requests for compassionate use from around the country.
Okay, we're wrapping up. We have three indications already in the clinic. There's two, however, that are still a little bit of blue sky. I just want to briefly mention them. And if you could briefly describe them for me. One is for CABG, and one has to do with treating diabetic patients, type 1. Could you just touch on those very briefly?
So because our manufacturing platform is a platform, we can make tissues of different shapes and sizes. So while all the clinical work is going on, we've also made a smaller caliber version of our vessel that's 3.5 millimeters in diameter. And this is a size that's suitable for heart bypass operations, coronary bypass. So like that patient I talked about at the beginning, this may be a vessel that one day would be suitable for that type of patient. We're studying those vessels right now in large animals, in pigs and in non-human primates, to gather sufficient data to support an IND filing at the FDA. In addition, we're beginning primate work using our current HAV, the 6-millimeter vessel, as essentially a delivery vehicle, as a way of delivering a therapeutic number of pancreatic islets that secrete insulin to patients with diabetes. This is really solving, or I hope will really solve, the delivery problem of getting enough islets into a patient and ensuring they survive so that they can sense glucose and secrete insulin. So that project is in an earlier stage. We've published some of our results in rodents, and we're beginning primate work this month, actually.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to progress on both those programs. Now I have two more questions, one for the lawyers, one for the bankers. The lawyer's question is, where is the IP for all this stuff?
So the IP is, part of it is licensed from academic institutions where I've previously lived at Duke and at Yale University.
Okay.
But the majority of our IP is invented in-house and owned by Humacyte. So it's either exclusively licensed or owned exclusively by us. But in addition, we also have a substantial amount of trade secret with respect to our culture medium and our bioreactors and our cell sources. So we believe that there's a really strong moat around the company and its technology.
All right. Well, let's talk if how much money is in that moat. The question for the banker is, what is your current runway? I know you talked about some very excitable VCs from a number of years back. I hope they're still with you. What's your runway?
So our runway right now should take us into early 2025. That accounts for cash that we have on hand, as well as a debt facility that's available to us. Since we anticipate filing our BLA in the middle of 2023, that should take us well past our first approval and commercialization launch. So unlike many companies in the current time who may be strapped for cash, but who are really dreading the thought of doing an equity offering, Humacyte is blissfully not in that position. We count ourselves as very fortunate.
Oh, congratulations. You must have had a very pleasant JP Morgan. Ladies and gentlemen, that is a wrap. Today, I have been speaking with Dr. Laura Nicholson. She is the founder and CEO of Humacyte. Doctor, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's Benchtop Bios. I hope that this episode will serve as yet another data point to guide you in your investment strategies. If you wish to hear more of LifeSize Benchtop Bios, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or Google. Also, if there's a company or a particular executive you'd like to get to know, I do take requests. Please send those to ncanavan@lifesizeadvisors.com. Until next week then, goodbye, or for that matter, good sell, whatever boosts your portfolio.